This is an ABC podcast.
Well, for more than three decades, he's lived with the prospect of pro-Iranian Islamic retribution. Thankfully, Salman Rushdie is recovering right now with his usual defiance. But he's not the only one facing death threats over words on a page.
I'm not going to give up my fight. And my message to Islamic Republic is just this. Go to hell, Khamenei. I'm not scared of you.
Yeah, fiery woman. You're about to meet her here on RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. Thanks for your company. That's Iranian-American journalist Masi Alinejad. She's in FBI protection right now after a man was arrested stalking her house with a loaded AK-47. She says too often the fear of being labelled Islamophobic prevents people from pushing back against this kind of Iranian loyalism. You won't want to miss my interview with her coming up shortly. Also, I bet you didn't know that the Prime Minister, well, the old one, Prime Minister Morrison, was also Minister for Health, Finance and Resources. Well, don't be too hard on yourself. Even federal ministers in those jobs were none the wiser.
I certainly found it unusual. But as I said, I worked very closely with Scott through a very difficult period through COVID for the whole country. And mate, I'm just not going to throw him under a bus. I just won't.
That's one of the former resources ministers there, Keith Pitt. It really goes to the command and control model Scott Morrison famously employed. Just how secret was this and how legal under the Westminster system was it? You'll get to the bottom of this in 5 minutes' time. Also, it's Monday, so you probably opened your calendar this morning and you set up a to-do list, all the things you wanted to get done this week. But you're about to meet the organisational psychologist who's flipped that on its head and says that you need to write a don't-do list. Be part of the conversation. 0418 226 576 on the text line. You can tweet me at RN Drive, or if you're listening on the ABC Listen app, you can hit call and text in. Across Australia, you're with Andy Park, and this is RN Drive. Well, first up, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has accused his predecessor, Scott Morrison, of running a shadow government after revelations he was secretly sworn in as the joint minister for three portfolios during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic.
How is it that the Australian people can be misled, whereby we know now that Scott Morrison was not only being Prime Minister, but was Minister for Health, was Minister for Industry and Science, at the same time as resources, was the Minister for Finance.
Yeah, a man of many talents. Clearly, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese there speaking at a press conference earlier today. The Governor-General says he appointed Scott Morrison to administer these additional portfolios in accordance with Section 64 of the Constitution. Now, this change should never should have been made public on the, well, certainly on the Prime Minister and Cabinet website, but not only was it not listed, it seems much of his Cabinet was also unaware that he had taken on these extra responsibilities. So was it a power grab by the former Prime Minister or safeguarding in a time of crisis? Kim Rubenstein is a constitutional law expert at the University of Canberra. Welcome to you, Kim. Just how out of the ordinary was this self-appointment by Scott Morrison?
So I think we need to clarify a couple of things, Andy. First of all, he didn't appoint himself actually as Minister for Health or the other ministries. And I think this is an interesting technical point that we should sort of clarify at the beginning. Only the Governor-General can swear in someone as a minister, and that's not exactly what happened here. What appears to have happened is that in addition to being a Prime Minister responsible for the traditional acts that the ministerial arrangements would have set up, this ministerial arrangement was giving him responsibility over other acts that are normally within the responsibility of the Minister for Health. So he was still Prime Minister. What happened was that he was given extra responsibility for decisions under acts that were also under the responsibility of the Minister for Health. So that technical difference might sound technical, but it is important in a constitutional framework. I think the greater question, which is what you've identified, is the secrecy about this administrative arrangement. Because normally under machinery of government changes where these administrative arrangements occur, they're published on the Prime Minister's website and they are accountable to it for everybody to be able to look at and assess. Whereas, as you've identified and has been part of the news coverage today, even his fellow cabinet ministers were not aware of it, let alone the electors. And this is something that we should come back to in terms of our system of ministerial responsibility and how that links into our democratic system.
I want to come back to the question of whether or not this was publicised and whether or not that's normal or expected or processed in a second. But, I mean, the Governor-General has come out today and said that he appointed the former Prime Minister to administer several portfolios, as you said, in accordance with Section 64 of the Constitution. What exactly does the Constitution say about a Prime Minister holding multiple ministerial roles? And is the process for doing so clearly outlined?
Well, no is the simple answer, because there's no reference even to the Prime Minister in our Constitution. So Section 64 is quite clear that the Governor-General appoints officers to administer departments of state as the Governor in Council establishes. So we've got no reference to the Prime Minister. We have no reference to the specific ministries as such. What it does is set up a power for the head of the executive, being the Governor-General, to effectively set up ministers of state. And it is for the Prime Minister, together with the Prime Minister's Cabinet, to determine what they will advise the Governor-General to do. So in that sense, our Constitution sets up a framework similar to what we're discussing, to, you know, of course, discussing now. But it does highlight for the public gap between politics on the ground and what is actually stated in the Constitution. But I would say that makes even more significant the openness and transparency about what happens for, you know, democratic accountability.
Is it not true that previous cabinet reshuffles during the previous coalition government's tenure were listed on the Prime Minister and Cabinet Register of Administrative Arrangements? However,
yes,
these
that's right.
were not. So cut it whichever way you like. That government had previously advertised, is probably the wrong word, yes, but listed these changes. But this time around, when we're talking about health, finance and resources with Scott Morrison, they didn't.
So I think this is one of the questions that the current government should be looking into more closely. What was it about this particular administrative arrangement that gave rise to a decision, if there was one? I mean, these are the things that need to be uncovered now. What was the process around that? Because ultimately, in terms of ministerial accountability, each of these things should be accessible to the public and as a representation that they are exercising power on behalf of the people. And the Governor-General, in acting on the advice of the Prime Minister, is acting in terms of the responsibility to the people. And how can you fulfil that if the people are not even aware of that?
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese earlier today said the Australian public has been misled. It will lead to some form of inquiry. If you've just tuned in, Kim Rubenstein is here. We're talking about Scott Morrison's ministerial appointments, multiple appointments, as we've now learnt here on RN Drive. I mean, given that we're living through extraordinary times, Kim, would it have been wise for the government to have been upfront about what they were doing, to explain publicly what the Constitution allows for and why they did it, the reason why they did it?
Yes, look, I think this is the healthy aspect of the discussion, Andy, and one that I'm really keen to extend a bit more, because I think that there is a real healthy question here about sharing responsibility over ministerial areas of government, because not only even in a time of pandemic, but more broadly about the nature of power in our society, these are massive responsibilities for individuals, and ultimately having more than one individual responsible for areas of multiple acts under those particular government departments could actually be a very positive and healthy thing, in the sense that we have a system of not only individual responsibility but also collective responsibility. So the cabinet is ultimately responsible as a collective for individual decisions, but we could actually extend that more to actually say it could be helpful to have two ministers responsible as a way of saying power shouldn't just be singly possessed, but should actually be shared, and with appropriate accountability and decision-making issues around if there is a conflict between the two, how are decisions made and so forth. So I think that this is something that, in fact, could have been embraced in a positive way by the government of the day rather than being done secretly, and, in fact, should be one of the positives that flow from this discussion at this very moment, should we actually be more transparent about the extent of the responsibilities we're giving individuals, and really making more transparent that those individuals have to rely on other people to assist them in exercising those powers, and all of those processes should be more accountable.
Yeah, I take your point about more checks and balances. I mean, there are certainly some ministerial decisions over the last decade that I can think of that if it was spread across two ministers, certainly yes. The perception about it being just down to one minister thumbs up or thumbs down would have been improved.
Indeed.
On the text line 0418226576, Richard asks an excellent question and one that my mind went to straight away as well. He says, "Hi Andy, call me a cynic, but my first thought on hearing that the former Prime Minister held multiple portfolios was to wonder whether Morrison was receiving extra ministerial allowances on top of his Prime Ministerial salary. I don't know if we know that yet. What do you think? Have you heard anything?"
No, I'm not sure that those sorts of questions would have necessarily been at the top of his mind either. I think the significance is really about the notion of power being centralised, and what we want to do is to disaggregate that. Now, in a positive view, one could say, well, the Prime Minister was wanting to provide a framework if there was an issue, if the Health Minister became disabled by COVID. But surely that could have also easily been fulfilled by having the Governor General ready to, you know, ensure that another minister could take over if that arose, as opposed to having it done secretly as a backup. And it does raise in questions about what was the ultimate purpose in doing that without it being publicly accountable. And of course, only Scott Morrison can answer that.
As an expert in constitutional law, you must snigger a little bit to yourself when every, what, 3 or 4 years there is a Section 64, Section 34, all of a sudden there's a lot of armchair experts about what exactly our constitution says and doesn't. Do you think we fundamentally have a lack of understanding about our constitution?
Look, I do think that we need to engage people in civics and citizenship education more broadly, and I think our constitution is, of course, one of those most significant areas. And, of course, if we broaden this to discussion about constitutional change, this is a healthy discussion to be having. And, of course, the issue that is close to public discussion at the moment is the Uluru Statement from the Heart. So these issues about our constitution are vital in a democracy. Constitutions are foundational to really fundamental liberal democratic principles, and the more we discuss these publicly and show that there's sometimes a gap between what people think is in the Constitution, what actually is in the Constitution, that's healthy, as long as we can ensure that people have a better awareness in a way that enlivens them and makes them active citizens about wanting to become more aware and to have a role in either amending and updating the Constitution, or indeed in the very important role of being an elector. And this is the other point I'd say, Andy, in relation to it not becoming public until after the election. And that is one of the fundamental aspects of ministerial responsibility is, I'd say, as a contrast to the US system, where ministers of state are not elected, they are appointed by the president and they're not accountable in that same democratic sense. In our system, the Westminster system, the idea of having a minister being elected to Parliament is that extra check on their accountability for fulfilling that executive role to the people. And the only way that that can work in our democratic system is that their decisions are transparent and accountable in between elections, so that when we come to make a decision at the next election whether we want to re-elect them and have them as possible ministers of state again, we do so on the basis of assessing what they've done in that previous term. Well, if that is secret, then you cannot assess that, and that then undermines those democratic elements of ministerial accountability.
It's just incredible to my mind that no one in the opposition, the then opposition, picked up on this, and no one at the department level as well. I mean, being practical, departments are large places. They can be leaky. Yes. They can talk to the press. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible that we're only finding out about it now.
So then this comes to that broader question about integrity and transparency and the politicisation also of the public service. So if there were individuals in those various different departments who were responsible for administering the legislation that then had both the Prime Minister and another minister responsible, then there would be questions under, the protection of their own position. So not necessarily whistleblowing as such, but in that sense of those individual bureaucrats' responsibility to the public and how much, that what sort of freedom there is. And I guess this comes down to questions about independent commissions against corruption or just more broadly about the importance of instilling in our departmental offices transparency is key. And freedom of information legislation is another framework, again, that we saw diminished over the last term. All of those sort of structures within our parliamentary system, like the independence of an administrative appeals tribunal, having a freedom of information commissioner appointed, all those different structures are key to the transparency and health of the democracy. And I think over a succession of time, we saw the diminution of those accountability measures. And I think this discussion today adds into that sort of collection of the changed sense of entitlement that came with a more powerful executive, and that is something we should really be aware of, and that this government should do everything it can to reinstill those liberal democratic principles to ensure that transparency and accountability is the order of the day.
Well, Kim, all I can say is I wish all of the Australian citizenry had your passion for constitutional law. As one person on the text line says, Kim makes everything so easy to understand. Pleasure to have you company
that's
tonight.
That's very kind. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for your time.
That's Cheers. Kim Rubenstein, a professor of constitutional and citizenship law at the University of Canberra. She certainly is very passionate, isn't she? It's very infectious, I should say. She also ran as an independent Senate candidate for the ACT in the last election. Well, coming up, if you feel overwhelmed with all the things you have to do, an endless to-do list, maybe the secret here is to chuck out the to-do list and have a don't-do list. What's it all about? Well, it comes with big promises of productivity. You'll find out shortly. You're with Andy Park here on RN Drive. It's 22 minutes past six. Well, author Salman Rushdie is expected to lose an eye after being stabbed multiple times at an event in New York over the weekend. In a statement, his son said his usual feisty and defiant sense of humour remains intact despite his life-changing injuries. The man accused of attacking him in front of a live audience, 24-year-old Hadi Matar, entered a plea of not guilty at his first court appearance. It's been reported that he expressed sympathy for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard. Of course, you may recall that Salman Rushdie has a bounty on his head, that famous fatwa after the publication of the Satanic Verses back in 1988 when the Ayatollah Khomeini issued that fatwa over his portrayal of the Prophet Muhammad. Unfortunately, Salman Rushdie isn't the only writer to be targeted for their work in this way. Masih Alinejad is an Iranian-American journalist. I spoke to her earlier from the United States, where she's now in hiding after a man turned up on her Brooklyn doorstep with a loaded AK-47 2 weeks ago.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you feel when you heard about this attack on Salman Rushdie, first of all?
I was shaken. I got goosebumps. I was just, I'm going to be very honest with you. I was just screaming and just walking corner to corner in my house. And I was like, no, finally they did it. They did it. You know why? Because I'm coming from a country, Iran, where the leader of the Islamic Republic issued a fatwa against Salman Rushdie. Not only Khomeini made a fatwa against him, the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Khomeini, repeated the fatwa against his head. And many other officials promoted the fatwa against him. So that was, I was ashamed at the same time to be Iranian. At the same time, I was like, oh my God, this is happening in New York. I was like, I left my country to be safe here in New York. Now this is happening to Salman Rushdie. Salman Rushdie was my hero, you know? And I'm sure that he is the hero of millions of other people who dare to talk, to speak out against, like to speak up against Islamism, you know? So for me, we just broke my heart, and that's all.
You're actually in hiding yourself at the moment because of an incident that happened at your home in Brooklyn What can you tell us about what happened?
I am talking to you right now from my safe house. But look, this is 21st century. I'm not a criminal. Salman Rushdie is not a criminal. We both just express ourselves. I just give voice to voiceless people. I give voice to Iranian women who dare to challenge compulsory hijab law. They don't want to cover their hair. They want to enjoy their life. They want to be their true self. They want to go to stadium. They want to dance. They want to be a judge. They want to be a president. They want to be their true self. And I just give them a voice. And that's why I'm being the target of the Islamic Republic. Last year, the FBI stopped a kidnapping plot by the Islamic Republic. They were planning to kidnap me from U.S. soil. I mean, can you believe that? And this time the FBI told me that I have to move to safe house because a man with a loaded gun in front of my house trying to kill me.
You, in fact, uploaded the video, the doorbell video of this man surveilling your house. It's rather chilling considering what the police have allegedly found in his car after he visited your house. What sort of level of security are you requiring to have to keep yourself safe right now?
Safe. Oh, my God. The word safe is too luxury for us who talk against Islamism, Islamic ideology, Islamic Republic, Taliban. But I'm really thankful with the FBI. I'm under full protection. I mean, after when Salman Rushdie was under attack, the FBI actually was more worried about my safety. So I'm in the safe house. But to be honest, it's not just me. It's not just me. It's about the idea of assassinating people who dare to criticize the Islamic Republic, who dare to criticize Islamic ideology. You understand what I mean? It's like, look, there's been a fatwa against Salman Rushdie, and I'm sure there is a fatwa against all of those who dare to talk against Islamism. Right now that I'm talking to you, Iranian officials, Iranian mainstream media are celebrating the attack on Salman Rushdie. One of the title of one the main state newspaper is this. I cannot even read it. It's this. The eye of, oh my God. The eye of Satan being blinded. So they called Salman Rushdie a Satan, and they say that one of the eye of the Satan is being blinded right now. So this is the reality of the Islamic Republic. Many of the apologists in the West may say that, you know, the Iranian regime is backed, they backed off from the fatwa. This is a big lie. For many years, they actually created a foundation of Islamic terror. And that's why Salman Rushdie was the victim of a terror attack.
What about your family in Iran? I understand their safety has been under threat. There's been attacks. What has happened to them, and how worried are you about their safety?
Can you believe even answering to your question? It makes me nervous because I even don't want to talk about my family. Look, the Iranian regime put my own brother in prison for 2 years. They brought my sister on TV to denounce me publicly. They interrogated my 70-year-old mother for 2 hours because they asked her to take me to Turkey. The intelligence service actually told my mother that we're not going to hurt her. We want to meet her in Turkey. We just want to talk to her. And my brother exposed this. My brother just called me and said, don't go to Turkey. If mom called you to say, I mean, just say no, because this is the intelligence service. They ask mom to bring you to Turkey. And they put my brother in prison for 2 years. The Iranian regime even made a new law on my name saying that if any women, anyone in Iran sending videos to Mahsa Ahdinejad will be charged of up to 10 years prison. 10 years prison just for sending videos to me. Iranian state television made a fake news saying that Mahsa was raped by 3 men because she undressed herself in the subway in London. You see, kidnapping, killing, torturing is in the DNA of the Islamic Republic. It's not about me being worried about myself or my family. I'm worried about many other activists, journalists, authors, intellectual, that they don't have such a level of protection right now that I'm having. You know what I mean? Mm. Right now that I'm talking to you, Swedish citizen, British citizen, UK citizen, German citizen, Jamshid Sharmad is in prison in Iran. They're being used like bargaining chip by the Islamic Republic to get a deal from Western countries. I'm not scared of my life. I'm very honest with you. I have only one life. I'm not scared of being killed, but I don't want to die. You know, I'm scared of the world, the democratic world, that they're watching this. In the eyes of the democratic world, this is happening, that the Islamic Republic assassinating, kidnapping and killing not only Iranian people, even like trying to assassinate and kill people on the Western soil.
And on that issue, the man accused of the Salman Rushdie attack is of Lebanese background but was born in California. He's also expressed sympathy for Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Does it shock you that someone from that background who's grown up in the United States could be radicalized that way?
Not at all. Not at all. You know why? Because I have been saying this for years and years and years and years on my Twitter. Please go on my Twitter. I've been saying that for years and years, that when the tech companies do not kick out all the dictators like Khamenei from Twitter, of course he can encourage like people like Hadi Matar, you know? It's like Khamenei banned 18 million people, Iranian people, from using Twitter. But he himself is allowed to use like Twitter, enjoy his freedom of speech on Twitter, and repeated the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. Hey, if anyone hear me right now, Khamenei can encourage your own son, your own teenager, ask the tech companies to kick out Taliban and Khamenei from Twitter. This is not calling like respecting freedom of speech. It's not. You are actually respecting the terrorists to use tech companies, to use social media to encourage people like Hadi Matar or any other young generation in the West to go and kill people who dare to criticize Islam. You know, you understand me? Mm. I've been saying this for years and years, but nobody cares. Because people say that, oh, this is Islamophobia. So that's why they don't want to even touch the issue. But phobia is an irrational fear. My fear of Islamic ideology, my fear is my fear of Taliban, my fear of the Islamic leaders, my fear of the Islamic Republic is rational. Because Khamenei used Twitter to encourage the young generation in the West. He actually published a letter to the young generation in the West and saying that you have to care about Islam. You have to actually criticize those who dare to, refuse Islam. So that's why I'm not shocked. I'm not surprised, because I know that the tech companies allowing Taliban and Khamenei, the Islamic Republic, to encourage people like Hadi Matar to go and assassinate Salman Rushdie and me.
Massey, I think I can predict your answer here, but in the long term, is your work and your activism sustainable given the level of threat? You're currently in FBI protection. Will they silence you?
Thank you so much for predicting that. Never, never, never. I'm not going to give up. You know why? Because I have only one life. And my life is not different than the lives of like Puya Bakhtiari, Pejman Gholipur. I know that you don't want me to name them because maybe you don't even understand these names. But Iranian regime killed 1,500 people only in 3 days in Iranian protest. So these are not just names to me. These are not just statistics to me. These are the people who had a dream to get rid of the Islamic regime. Taliban is kicking out the girls from school and beating up the women in this industry right now that I'm talking to you. So, okay, I'm under protection of the FBI. I cannot enjoy my freedom. You understand my anger? So that's why I'm not going to give up. Even they kill me, I don't care, because I'm not scared of being dead or being killed. This is the difference between me and the leaders of the Islamic Republic and Taliban. I care about my dignity, and I dedicate my life for those who don't have voice inside Iran. But what is scary for me is just clear. The democratic countries who are keen and desperate to get a deal with the Islamic Republic. What is scary for me, the Western media, the Western politicians, they don't even dare to say that the guy who actually attacked Salman Rushdie motivated by the Islamic Republic. They don't even dare to talk about that. I dare to talk about that. I even want to go to the same place that Salman Rushdie got attacked, because I'm not scared of my life. But this is scary that the whole world is watching, that the Islamic Republic is killing, murdering, taking hostage. That is scary for me. I'm not going to give up my fight. And my message to Islamic Republic is just this. Go to hell, Khamenei. I'm not scared of you. I'm going to fight back the Islamic Republic and Islamic ideology.
Masih Alinejad, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I do hope that you can continue your work and to stay safe. I appreciate your time tonight.
Your support means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
That's Masih Alinejad, an American-Iranian writer. I should add that I did invite Iran's ambassador to Australia to join us on the show to comment on allegations that the Revolutionary Guard is targeting individuals overseas because of their activism. He declined the offer, saying these matters have nothing to do with the Iranian government. On the text line, Charles from Lismore really sums up that interview with Masih. He says, I can't remember an interview with a more impressive blend of unabridged passion, logic and accuracy. This is anger transcendent. Yeah, she's certainly one to watch in that space. Well, coming up nearly 5 years on from the Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sex abuse, Bondi's Orthodox Yeshiva College has had its license revoked because of its failure to protect its students. I'll speak to Manny Wax, who's been campaigning for Jewish schools to be held to account for their failures. That's coming up on RN Drive. You're with Andy Park. It's 21 minutes to 7. I am a big fan of to-do lists. I reckon on my phone right now I've got three. There's the to-do work, things at work, to-do home, things to do around the house, and then one which is solely dedicated to items I keep forgetting to buy from one well-known green hardware chain. What's been on your to-do list today? Was it a moderate list of achievable tasks? Or maybe it was a list so full, you'd have to be superhuman to get all your tasks done and still be in one piece. When you think of what was on your list today, was there anything you could have just deleted? What were the things that de-energized you, as they say these days? What was the things on that list that, well, probably took it out of you so much that the ones afterwards on the list didn't get done? Whether it's a light on the list or one packed to the brim, there's sure to be things on the list that don't work in your favour. Well, as a to-do list, maybe all you need is a don't do list. Have you heard of this? Throw out the to-do list. You need a don't or to don't do list. I know it gets very confusing. I'd love to hear from you if you've got some tips on how you manage your to-do or don't-do lists. Maybe there's a few things on there you could take off. Then if you did, what would happen? Nothing. The sky wouldn't fall in. Just because you've got it on a list doesn't mean you're going to do it. Love to hear from you. 0418226576. Organisational psychologist and author of the book Timewise, Dr. Amantha Imba, loved her to-do list. But now she also loves her don't lists. Yes, she's here to tell us why. Good evening, Amantha. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Andy. Good to be here.
So what is this don't do list? I mean, I don't need to list all the things I don't do because I don't do them. They stay undone forever.
That's good to hear. Well, the to-don't list is all about the fact that life, particularly for those that do live by their to-do lists, I mean, so much of that is just adding and adding and adding. And if you have a to-do list, it's really rare to actually get to the end of it because there's always more to do. But time is finite. We can't just get more time. And so the to-don't list comes from the idea of, well, if we can live a life where we're more mindful of how we use our time, then surely we need to be subtracting the things rather than just adding things so that we can, you know, feel more energized and get rid of the things that do de-energize us and deflate us.
That is interesting because I keep on having this conversation with my wife that, you know, the pie doesn't get bigger. You know, I can't find any more time. It's finite, as you just said. The trick is, I suppose, shifting your thinking about a to-do list being a task and a to-don't-do list is spending time, how you don't want to spend time.
Exactly. So for me, for example, what I do, I literally have a meeting booked in my diary on the first Monday of every month where Monday at 4 o'clock I will sit down and I'll reflect on the month that has just gone and I'll think about what were the things that I did in terms of how I used my time that felt de-energizing or deflating or just made me feel
like what?
A
like,
little bit.
What are we talking
miserable.
Here? Is it like cleaning the bathroom? I mean, we've all got to do these things. I don't know if coming up with a fancy list is going to get me out of doing them.
Well, it is thinking about the things that maybe we do have a choice. So, for example, like I think about different categories of my life from work to personal to family and front, you know, in a recent reflection, I was thinking about this friend that I catch up with, you know, every month or two, and I am often the one that instigates the catch-ups. And I was thinking the last few catch-ups, I've walked away from them just feeling a bit blur, like not really, you know, feeling sparky with energy after, you know, the chats that we've had. And so on my to-don't list that month, I thought, well, I'm not going to proactively reach out to this friend. I'd prefer to use the time that I, you know, catch up with friends, catching up with people who do make me feel, you know, kind of rejuvenated. So, you know, that's an example where it's a choice which friends I see and just being conscious around who I choose to spend time with.
Now, you had a conversation a couple of years ago with Rachel Botsman, a trust fellow from Oxford University, about to-don't lists. This is the genesis for this. How did it sort of work its way into your work and your life?
Yeah, so I connected with Rachel through the podcast that I host called How I Work, where I interview some of the world's most successful people, CEOs, entrepreneurs, artists, writers, about how they structure their days and how they use their time, with the theory being people that have risen to the top of their fields, surely they're using their time more wisely than us mere mortals. And so Rachel told me about her to-don't list on one of the times that I had her on How I Work. And I ended up writing about that concept in my new book, Timewise, where I talk about different strategies that people use for, you know, being more mindful about how they use the hours in their day.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mind shift, sort of a mindset shift, I should say, because so often we are task-oriented, not the pleasure that we're deriving from the time that we have. Lots of people are chiming in on the text line, 0418226576. Tony says, don't have more than one item as a priority. Well, that's tough if you've got a job and a family and all other things. This is a great one too. It's simple. Don't make lists unless you are prepared to admit to failure. I think that might resonate with you.
Definitely. I mean, look, I do love a good list, but also just that previous comment about priorities. Like the word prioritize, by and large, means you can only have one priority. And it was only recently in the English language that we began talking about priorities, plural, which kind of doesn't really make sense because the priority is the single most important thing. So I do think that is definitely worth reflecting on, particularly with jobs where we have multiple priorities. Well, that's kind of, you know, not how that word was originally intended.
There is a certain level of catharsis when you cross off the thing on your list that you've been dying to get. This is a great text from Rob. He says, one of the greatest joys in life is going through my many, many scraps of paper with lists on them and then crossing off all the things that I don't need to be done anymore because they're just gone past their use-by date. So if you leave things long enough, maybe you change and you don't care any longer. But this idea of deducting time, I think, is an interesting one. So if someone's keen to sort of get started with this theory of to-don't lists, how do you start?
Well, I think firstly thinking about what is a regular time, maybe once a month, where you can sit down on your own and just have some space to reflect on the month that has gone and really write a list of what were the things that you do that that really kind of sucked the life out of you or that were kind of a bit dull, things that, there are obviously things that we have to get done in life, but there's also a lot that is actually optional or also things that you can delegate or maybe automate. So once you've developed this list, it's good to do it once a month so that you do kind of keep reflecting on behaviours rather than just live your life on autopilot. Go through the list and think about, firstly, what can you just stop doing, without it having a negative effect on your life? But also think about, are there things that you could delegate? Maybe it could be a chore that you give to your child, for example. Maybe there are things that you could automate. Look, there will still be things that we all have to do that are sort of the, general drudgery of life. But I think, you'd be surprised at how much we can actually get rid of.
Well, Amantha, as the great Yoda said, do or not do, there is no try. I think this is an important way for us to reconsider the time we have and maybe do away with all those little bits of paper. Dr. Amantha Imber, organisational psychologist and author, great to chat to you.
Thanks, Andy.
Coming up, it's a gadget that could save you heaps of money on your power bill. They're very common in North America and in Europe. So given the cost of power, not to mention the emissions, why doesn't every house in the country have one of these widgets that you've never heard of? Well, the Carbon Counter is on the way here on RN Drive, 12 minutes to 7. Well, Yeshiva College in the Sydney suburb of Bondi has today had its education registration cancelled for failing to comply with child protection requirements. The New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal also found the school didn't comply with several governance regulations. The New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies has released a statement saying it's concerned and alarmed with the findings and there should be no tolerance for institutions which are not fully compliant with relevant child protection requirements. Joining me now is Manny Wax. He's the CEO of Voice Against Child Sex Abuse and a former student of Yeshiva College. Manny, were you surprised by the findings and can the school even open tomorrow? Do we know that?
Absolutely gobsmacked by that announcement today because it was shut down, the Yeshiva Centre in Bondi, Yeshiva College, because of a variety of concerns about child safety, but also misuse of government funds, diverting them to Jewish studies teachers. And it also found that the responsible person, Rabbi David Slavin, was not a fit and proper person to lead such an institution. And David Slavin came to the Royal Commission investigation back in 2015 and was giving all sorts of assurances about changing the culture and doing what needs to be done. And unfortunately, what we have seen is absolutely shocking, and the Jewish community, I can say those who I've spoken to, are shocked and are unsure as to the safety of the children who are born in that school system.
Manny, we're just having a little trouble hearing you. If you could speak up or talking to the phone, that might help things. I apologise for that. So what were some of the compliance issues which the school had been notified about but failed to rectify?
Well, it's all related, or many of them are related to child safety, child protection, related matters, whether it's working with children's checks related matters, whether it's training levels of the teachers. They were supposed to be given a proper, comprehensive education around child protection, but instead of that, only one person really was given proper training, while the rest of them were given some ad hoc, just insufficient training. And again, it's important that we link what has happened today with the Royal Commission findings not so long ago. 2017 it finished. And back at the time when the Royal Commission examined the Chabad, Chabad is the Hasidic movement, which runs the yeshiva centres in both Melbourne and Sydney, what we said at the end of that was that these institutions were rotten to the core, they needed to be shut down, and were ultimately beyond rehabilitation. And what we're seeing today is that we were proved right about Sydney, and we expect that ultimately we'll also be proved right about Melbourne. They seem to believe that the rules of the land applies to them, and ultimately they're a danger to children. And I can tell you also that we're currently dealing with dozens of cases of children being sexually abused at yeshiva in Melbourne in recent years. So from our perspective, these are institutions, and I'll go back just to focusing on the Yeshiva College in Sydney. It's an institution that should have been probably shut down a long time ago, and I heard with interest the statement issued by the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies. I mean, they are our communal body. They were involved in the Royal Commission investigation, and at the end of that, they also gave evidence that they set up a task force to ensure that all communal schools, including yeshiva, was compliant, and moving forward, things will be great. Now, they can be shocked, and they can say all sorts of comments, they criticize in yeshiva, etc., but I think some of the responsibility lies with them. Because ultimately, if we talk about issues of anti-Semitism or any other security matters for the Jewish community, they would have been at the forefront of addressing it.
Okay.
And now we have a case where it's become a little bit too little, too late.
Manny, we're going to have to leave it there. I do apologise about the phone line quality there, but I do appreciate your time. Manny Wax is the CEO of Voice Against Child Sex Abuse and a former student at Yeshiva College. Here on RN Drive, you're with Andy Park.
This is Cole. Don't be afraid.
You have stolen my dreams.
A green hydrogen powerhouse.
Let's talk about climate change.
Yeah, something new and different is bringing to Radio National climate alarmism. I mean, honestly.
How dare you?
This is the last chance.
Yes, this is the Carbon Counter, your day's news in a decarbonising economy. Now, prior to the war in Ukraine, Europe was already embracing heat pumps. It's a bit of a foreign concept for Australians to get their head around. But the imperative to get off Russian gas has supercharged that effort and turned it into an emotionally charged issue. Now, the European Commission now has a plan to double the number of heat pumps deployed, which is a more or less a domestic household bit of kit, with Germany announcing a heat pump offensive. Sounds impressive. This would take the annual install rate of heat pumps around the world to 160,000 in a year to 500,000 per year in 2024. Now, Thomas Nowak is the really at the forefront of Europe's push to move away from Russian gas, and he's here in Australia to meet governments and other stakeholders to help with our energy crisis. But before that, he is a guest here in the Carbon Counter. Thomas, welcome to you.
Thank you, Andy.
I understand you've just stepped off a plane in Brussels, so I do appreciate you making the time. A lot of people listening to this won't know what a heat pump is. Just break it down for me.
Well, there's first and foremost, everybody has a heat pump. If fridge market penetration is 97%, look into your kitchen, you have a fridge, you know how a heat pump works. But then how does it really work? Because most people also don't know how a fridge works. So you jump into the water, you step out, you feel cold. Then the water evaporates. That's the first effect. And then imagine you hop on the bicycle and you have a flat tire, so you have to pump it up. And if you pump air, you compress the gas, then the temperature increases. You can do that. If you can feel that if you pump very hard, the tip of the bicycle pump will heat up. So you have evaporation and compression. You put this into a cycle that is closed, it's sealed, and then you let it run. And that's what a heat pump is doing. So it takes energy from the environment, from air, water, ground, also waste energy from a building, for example, and brings it to a higher level. And it provides cooling at the same time.
So if they are so ubiquitous in things like fridges, what other applications could there be, certainly for Australians, in terms of space heating or other water heating, other kinds of applications?
Yeah, we in Europe, we say that for residential and commercial applications, heat pumps are ready. The technology is there, both for new buildings and for renovation projects. And I would assume that looking at the different climate zones of Australia, the same is true. You can do heating, cooling, hot water. If you need heating and cooling at the same time, you will achieve stellar efficiency. And if you look at office buildings, most of them have heat pump technologies. It's only called a cooling device or a ventilation device, but quite often heat recovery is part of the game. And we are in Europe now focusing on industrial applications because the decarbonization of industry is one of the overlooked aspects of the whole decarbonization journey, and it also uses a lot of gas. So here we know that we have operating heat pumps at temperature levels of around 140 degrees, and prototypes run at 180 up to 200 degrees centigrade. So we assume that about 10 to 20% of all the heat that is used in industry can be provided by heat pumps with current technology, and of course there is an increasing opportunity with technological progress.
So there's this tremendous opportunity, if you like, for heat pumps to be a central component of Europe and Australia's future energy systems, both at the domestic and industrial levels. But when it comes to Europe's want to wean off Russian gas, this is where it gets particularly interesting.
Yeah, that's true. We have roughly calculated 1 million heat pumps is the equivalent of 1 billion cubic meters of Russian gas, or of any gas, actually, because I think there is one short thing that needs to be clarified. It's not only Russian gas that we have to get rid of. It's not helping if we replace Russian gas with other gas. We have to get rid of gas altogether. And heat pumps can do that. Currently, Europe is importing 155 billion cubic meters. So By principle, if we would replace all the heating systems in buildings that are running on fossils, then we could pretty much replace all the imports with heat pumps as we stand. And that is, again, it's a huge challenge, but the technology exists. So what we have to do in Europe is we have to look at the processes on the ground. At the moment, we even have such a big demand that industry and installers can't deliver. So there is shortcomings here and there in both parts of the value chain. But there is also a lot of investment. So the investment community has picked up on the opportunity that comes with heat pump development. The aspect that heat pumps can provide demand-side flexibility has brought new players to the market, utilities namely, because they understand that they can offer new services to their customers. And I hope that the current problems that we have will be overcome in about 18 months. And then I think it's the start of a growth market. We have to see double-digit growth, 20-25% for this, for all the years in this decade to achieve the targets. And that's also true for Germany that you mentioned just now. Germany would need 25% additional heat pumps every year to reach the 6 million units that the government has announced as a target for 2030.
And I understand that on your visit to Australia, you're meeting with federal and state governments and other stakeholders. What sort of level of feedback are you getting in terms of the application and localized application for heat pumps? Just briefly, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, that would be too fast to say what I'm what will be the outcome. But what we want to discuss is, can Australia learn from Europe? Can you avoid making the mistakes that maybe Europe has made 10 years ago? And I think that's an important part, because we see in Europe that it has taken governments a long time to accept that heat pumps do work and that it's no mistake for them to support heat pumps. There was always this idea of technology neutrality, and that left the door open for fossil heating systems. And what I would like to see, and if Australia could step forward in that, would be technology clarity. It would be something where you say, as governments, okay, you know, we want the end users to choose the cleanest solution, and that has to be also the most economic solution, because it cannot be done by government budgets. So one of the outcomes that we're also pushing for in Europe is to say, let's create a market framework that makes it attractive for all end users, both residential, commercial and industrial, to choose heat pumps, because that will drive markets and that will bring them, in the long term at least, to have the cheapest possible heating and cooling solution without being depending on fossil fuels.
Very interesting technology, and we're looking with interest to see how your meetings go. Thomas Nowak is the Secretary General of the European Heat Pump Association. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Andy. Have a nice evening.
It's coming up to news time here on ABCRN. And look, thanks for so much for your text. I think this sums it up when it comes to to-do lists. When I tell my children I'm multitasking, they often reply with, "No, Dad, you're multi-failing." I think we can all relate to that, can't we? News time on ABCRN. It's 7 o'clock. Welcome back. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. Have you ever felt like the decisions of the people in power don't necessarily have your best interests at heart? That there's a game being played behind the scenes that you're not invited to? Well, coming up tonight in the drawing room, I'll be joined by economist Cameron J. Murray to talk about his book Rigged and the way that political favours for mates are costing the rest of us in time and money. It's a fascinating chat on air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. You're listening to RN Drive across Australia. I'm Andy Park. To Afghanistan now, where it's been a year since the Western-backed government of Ashraf Ghani collapsed and the Taliban returned to power. Despite promises that life would be better under the Taliban Mark II, life, especially for women and young girls, has gone backward, with the Islamist regime having to deal with an ongoing drought, COVID, and of course, a broken economy. Nargis Nihan was a former Afghan government minister before the Taliban takeover. She joins me now. Welcome back to RN Drive, Nargis.
Thank you.
12 months has passed since this, well, those chaotic images of the US withdrawal. You managed to flee with your family, but I remember when we spoke to you last, you had to leave your elderly father behind. Can I just ask, were you able to bring him out of Afghanistan?
Yes, actually, after 6 months of a lot of struggle, his health really deteriorated in Kabul. And I was able to communicate with the government of Canada, and with their support, I was able to get them first to Pakistan. And from Pakistan, we managed to get them to Norway.
Ah, well, that's
so thank God
a small piece of good news.
Yes, very much. Yes, thank you.
You still keep in contact with people, especially women in Afghanistan. Just paint me a portrait of how life has changed for them.
Well, I'm in contact not only with women, with men and women and many different groups all around the country because there's a lot that, like, I'm working and I'm in contact with them, I'm engaging with them. So imagine in a society where you don't have constitutional order, where you don't have state institution, where you don't have a government that would have a social contract with the people, it's very difficult for people to have a normal life. And that's what's happening in Afghanistan right now. So since 1 year, the state institutions are not functional anymore. The de facto government does not feel the responsibility of providing any services for the people, but they do feel the responsibility of putting more control and restrictions on people. The security has deteriorated. I'm sure you must have heard about different sets of attacks that we had, especially on Shia minorities. On top of that, the climate change, whether we are talking about earthquake, whether we are talking about flood, has really taken the country into another level of the crisis. The country is really sinking in poverty. Women are literally stripped of all their rights. 33 decrees are being issued by the Taliban in these 12 months, putting all the restrictions on women and stripping all their rights. And then on top of that, the economic situation of the country has really deteriorated. So overall, Afghanistan has gone at least, we can say 2 to 3 decades backwards in just 12 months.
I've heard anecdotes of former police women in the Kabul police force now forced to beg on the street. We've heard stories about secret schools for young women who aren't allowed to attend school. How widespread are those secret schools? I mean, are we talking about underground classrooms or what is it like?
The good thing this time around is the technology that we have. So with the technology, the secret schools are happening and they are literally happening in each and every houses. And the technology is also providing the girls the opportunity to attend online classes. There are so many organizations that I'm in contact. They're providing online English classes, online computer classes, and online different classes for the girls. But Andy, you must know that aspirations of Afghan women are very high. So secret schools are good in the short term, but they can never respond to the situation that we have for education of our women, because how much you can teach girls in a basement in a secret school. You can teach them numeracy, you can teach them literacy, but you cannot teach them technology, you cannot teach them science. For that, they have to be in educational institutions. I'm sure you must have heard that even yesterday, again, women went out on the streets and they protested for their rights.
Incredible vision of them confronting the cultural police on the street. I mean, that is some sort of bravery, which would have a pretty high consequence, I imagine.
Imagine the consequences. I am in contact with them. And we were really worried about them. We said, be very careful, whatever you are doing, don't put yourself in danger. But then they are saying that, look, we cannot accept the situation anymore. So they have gotten to the point that they are going, they knew very well the consequence of that. They saw what happened to the girls when they went out on the streets last year and protested for their rights. But still they are going out and they are protesting for their rights because the current situation is not acceptable for them. And the only disappointment is that the world is just, after 12 months, is still watching and are not doing enough for Afghan people, especially women.
We know that Afghanistan is facing severe food shortages, in part linked to the droughts you just mentioned. We've heard stories of people starving, even alarming reports of people selling their own children just to eat, an unconscionable situation to be forced to be in. Do you think Western governments should be doing more here, even if they have to negotiate with the Taliban?
Look, Andy, it's not only the children. People have also begun selling parts of their body, including their kidney, to be able to bring food on the table for their family members. So the international community is responsible, whether they admit it or they don't admit it. They are responsible for the situation that we have inside Afghanistan, with the irresponsible intervention that they had, with the irresponsible engagement that they had in the last two decades, and with the irresponsible withdrawal that they had. So they should feel the responsibility and they should provide support for Afghan people. And for that, we're not saying that don't engage with the Taliban. Yes, they should engage with the Taliban and they should find ways to provide support for people, especially to respond to the humanitarian catastrophe that we have right now going on in Afghanistan. But what is more important, that their engagement should not pave the way for the recognition of Taliban or should not empower Taliban.
On RN Drive, I'm speaking with former Afghan Minister Nargis Nihan, who was forced to flee to Toronto, Canada, when Kabul fell to the Taliban 1 year ago. Of course, Nargis, security is an ongoing problem in Afghanistan. Does the Taliban have control over the entire country, or are there still factional warlords who are, more or less holding out from the overarching rule of the Taliban?
The situation that we see in the last 12 months has deteriorated because of the fragmentation inside the Taliban. I'm sure you're aware that now they are divided in three different groups and branches. Every province are having their own rules, so the governors are deciding how they want to rule each province. There is not that single and strong chain of command when you had in previous time of the Taliban, because every commander in every province are coming with their own rules. And the rivalry have started already between the Taliban. There are a lot of internal conflict between them, attacks happening between them. And besides having these internal conflict amongst themselves, ISIS is very much active in Afghanistan. You saw the number of attacks that they had on the Shia minorities in different parts of the country, especially in Kabul. You must have also read the news that they found Al-Zawahiri in the heart of the diplomatic area of Kabul. So that says a lot about Taliban's lack of control. But it's not only about lack of control. It's also about Taliban's relation with Al-Qaeda and the rivalry with ISIS that exists there. No matter how much we try to ignore them and oversimplify the situation of Afghanistan and try to convince others that Taliban have changed and we can convince them to give up their relation with Al-Qaeda, to give up their violence, to give up their relation with other terror group and govern Afghanistan peacefully, that is not possible. They cannot give up all those relations that they've had in the last two decades with Al-Qaeda. Even if the leaders would try to do it, their foot soldier would not do that.
Just lastly, Nargis, you're living in Toronto now. Thankfully, your father is out. Can you imagine, in your wildest dreams, being able to return to Afghanistan in the next few years?
I'm counting day and night for the time that I'll be able to return back to my country and once again like continue my work on the ground. Of course, it's difficult and I cannot do it until I don't have the security assurance and I don't have the assurance that I can continue my activism. But the day that I have that assurance that I'm secure and I continue my activism, I don't think I'll be staying an hour longer in Toronto. I would be packing and leaving back. And I think it's not only me, it's many of the other Afghan men and women activists that they're just waiting for the opportunity to go back to Afghanistan.
Nargis Nihan was a minister in the last Afghan government before the Taliban takeover. Thanks so much for your time. Great to hear from you.
Thank you.
Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to The Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. You don't have to look far in the political news at the moment to find a story about mates doing favours for mates. But while some cases of government mateship reach the front page and the investigative bodies, many of them slide through in the grey area of just how things are done, how things work. But a backroom favours and a revolving door between regulators and industries they govern, really a natural part of doing business. Rigged by Cameron K. Murray and Paul Freiters looks at the game of mates in Australia and sets out to explain the cost. Cameron K. Murray is a research fellow at the University of Sydney and my guest in the drawing room. Welcome to you, Cameron. Come on in. Take a seat.
Thanks very much, Andy.
What was the context around at the time when you started looking and thinking about these issues with Paul back in 2010?
Yeah, so prior to that, I'd worked for a number of property developers and I'd also worked in government regulation. And I'd actually decided that, the system was rigged, that it was very hard to get objective decision-making. And I actually decided that I was done being an economist and thought I'd become a medical doctor, would you believe?
Just a lazy extra 8 years at uni or 10 if you include the extras.
Exactly. But, there was a lot of frustration there, having been on both sides, seen the games that were played in planning decisions, infrastructure investment decisions, in regulation. I remember working for the Queensland regulator, moving into a new department, and the person I'd replaced had revolved out to work for the lobbyist of the industry we were regulating. And I sat in his desk the next day and then had to pick up the phone and talk to him on the other side of these regulatory negotiations. And it was all a little bit too cozy for my liking. Anyway, Paul Freiters was a professor at UQ at the time, and he convinced me that you can do good things with economics, and maybe I could look a little bit deeper into these topics in a more systematic and rigorous way. And so I started a PhD at UQ looking at political favouritism, or what we also call now grey corruption, which is the sort of totally legal favour trading that we see, as you mentioned, with these appointments of mates that result in very, very costly decisions by government that end up passing the cost on to everybody else. And that's where we ended up taking a more economic approach to it, is quantifying the cost from having the system we have in different areas compared to world's best, and identifying how small groups of well-networked mates kept things the way they were and avoided any change that sort of recouped the cash for the rest of us.
The structure of your book pits James, the connected mate, against Sam, the ordinary Aussie. No one notices James at first. He sort of is a bit of a grey man. The favours for mates go unseen for a long time. What's important about that initial kind of behaviour, which isn't of itself corrupt, which leads to later corruption?
Yeah, so the big challenge is understanding how these relationships are sustained. So one of the puzzles of economics is, why would I give someone a favor if they don't immediately, you know, pay me, essentially? Why is it not a trade? And so the economic reasoning there is that, well, you're doing it on credit. You offer one favor, that shows that you're willing to participate, and then in the future that gets reciprocated. And the way the trust is built up between those networks is very slowly and over a long period of time. And so you end up with people who have been to high school together, worked together in certain environments, been in the right clubs at the right places at the right time, that end up doing small incremental favors for each other over time, building that trust so that you only notice in the future when those favors get much bigger and much more obvious and much more costly to the rest of us. So it is a long-term sort of lifetime investment in favor trading. So that's sort of, you know, the logic of how this unfolds.
Which involves, when you think about it, an incredible level of trust that you can pay it forward for someone and scratch their back in the day. And these networks often come about when there has been trust between the individuals in organisations, whether it be schools or universities or former mm-hmm. workplaces.
Yeah, exactly. That's the interesting thing, I think, that we bring. A lot of the commentary around political favours, the revolving door, is sort of portraying this as selfish and nasty and mean. But in reality, it's a very pro-social, pro-mate, look after your friends, doing what you can for your group. It's just that that group is a small subset of the rest of society. And the fact that when you do your mates the favour, it costs everybody else. So yes, you need to build up trust. And one of the puzzles there is, how do you know who you can trust? How do I know if I'm going to favour somebody that they will reciprocate either to me or indirectly to others in our group in the future? And so there's a great game of signaling going on. I like to say, for example, that political donations are signals of creditworthiness or loyalty to the group. So we often think of political donations as a bribe, but they're much too small to be bribes. That's a big unresolved issue. If I can pay 10 or 20,000 in donations and get a political favor in return that's worth tens or $20 million, the politician has underpriced their bribe, right? And so donations are much more about signaling, hey, I'm going to burn money here. I'm going to just throw money at your political party to show that my credit is good and that you can trust me to reciprocate in the future. So that's one way that you nurture that trust over time.
I don't think it would surprise anyone who follows the news, particularly in New South Wales and in Sydney, that property development is one of the main industries you look at in this book. But why is property development such a source of scandal and mates doing favours for mates?
Yeah, so property development is, it's not really the development of new buildings that is where the favours are. The favours are in changing the rules in the planning system or in changing where the public is going to invest in new infrastructure that's going to favour landowners in certain areas and not others. And this ability for governments to change the rules, for example, the planning scheme, that has a huge private value for a landowner who, for example, used to only be able to have agricultural uses and now can do a residential subdivision, that planning change has a huge private value. And we call these decisions of government that have a big private value that don't cost the decision maker grey gifts. And they're kind of the currency of grey corruption. And they're very common in planning and infrastructure investments. So that's why we focus on property. Also, I used to work in the property development industry, so I'm somewhat familiar. And these planning decisions don't have to be given away for free. That's the interesting part. So in the ACT, if your land is upzoned, you're free to carry on the current use. But if you want to change the use and develop to that new additional right that the planning scheme granted you, you have to pay 75% of the market value of that additional right. And so we, for example, scale up. What if every state had the ACT system, and instead of planning decisions being just political favours that give away all this value, what if we charged for them? Well, we reckon you'd raise $19 billion a year just by adopting the ACT's existing system.
$19 billion. You think about what that could do for public education, public health. It is tempting, isn't it? Especially when this is, more or less value that goes into other people's pockets rather than common good.
It just goes to the increase in value of existing property owners. And as a good rule of thumb, there are 10 million households in Australia, so $19 billion is $1,900 per household per year is the value of this sort of honeypot of manipulating the planning system. And so clearly when there's that much value being given away through these discretionary favours each year, that's a huge incentive to start coordinating and building the trust and nurturing those networks and donating to the right parties and signalling your credit worthiness. And that's why we see corruption in property development at the council, the state and the federal level.
The other kind of lobbyist or lobbying activity you talk about is secret lobbyists. There's been some claims that Peter Costello is a secret lobbyist for James Packer, a claim that Nine have strenuously rejected. But putting aside Mr. Costello, what would it mean to be a secret lobbyist? How do you declare yourself as a lobbyist and does it even matter?
Yeah. Look, the lobbyist in lobbying industry is quite interesting because what we've done is we've formalized this process of lobbying that really we don't want to happen. But what each state has done is created a lobbyist register and said, well, as long as you write your name down here and tell us who your clients are, you're free to go about that thing that we used to think was bad. But now that you're registered, it's fine. So we don't really know how to regulate it. And it's also the case that not just lobbyists lobby, everybody lobbies. Lobbyists are all about nurturing those networks and building those trust, that trust that, you know, if their client is favoured, the lobbyist is vouching for that client. I'll tell you an interesting story about lobbyists because I looked at the relationship networks of landowners in a number of major upzoning decisions in Queensland. And what I did is create this this network with 12,000 entities of landowners, politicians, companies, directors, and I mapped all the relationships between them through cross-directorships, through lobbyist clients, their political donations. I scraped the database of former politicians to identify family members and former workplaces. So I had this mass of entities and relationships. And when I looked at landowners inside and outside rezoned areas, I could predict who got rezoned by their position in this network of relationships. But what was interesting is the lobbyists, being a client of a lobbyist was even better than being well connected. And the more interesting part is that when someone, I copied this method from a researcher who looked at organized crime gangs and mapped the relationship networks in organized crime gangs. And the same types of predictions I could make using this network on property development, he could make on who earned the most out of the organized crime gang. So there's this sort of innate pattern to this relationship network. And so the role of the lobbyist is more like vouching for the new member, right? You know, you pay the lobbyist to vouch for your credit, just like when you join the mafia, you need someone to vouch that you're loyal to them when you're trying to break into that social network as well. So that's how I see lobbying functioning. But it happens much more broadly than the lobbyists that are on the official registers.
Fascinating stuff. On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Cameron K. Murray is my guest in the drawing room. We're talking about his book, Rigged. So broadly, what are the impacts these games have on the average person? When you say that if someone does a favour for their group, whatever that group might mm-hmm. be, that in essence it takes away from the, whether it's ability to make income or the rights or legal access for another group. And you write that your research suggests that this game of mates takes half of the wealth of the average Australian away from. That's a pretty staggering claim.
Yeah. So I guess obviously we want to put the most sort of shocking claims as the headline. But let me explain how we get to these numbers. So there's two ways that this game can cost us. One is you can transfer resources from outsiders, from Sam to James and his mates, the insiders, and that's a cost to outsiders. The other way it costs us is we do the inefficient investments. So the economy itself grows more slowly because we end up making investments that favour insiders that aren't the best investments for the country as a whole. So I'll give you a little bit of an example there. When we have public-private sort of arrangements for toll roads, there's a real big incentive to pick roads that make the most toll revenue, not the roads that increase the throughput of the road network. And in fact, it can be the case that the best new toll road to build makes traffic worse everywhere else and makes more money because people are forced into that toll road. And we see many examples where explicitly in the contracts are written, oh, we're going to close down all these surface roads and funnel people into these toll roads. So what you're doing is you're spending billions for essentially no gain in travel time or travel throughput, but you're just transferring to insiders. So we have the missed opportunity of building a road that improves the network, and we have the transfer from outsiders and insiders. And when you combine the two costs, you end up with some very, very high costs.
We spoke earlier about potential solutions to this game of mates doing favours for mates. You spoke about the ACT example. What are some of the world's best practices? What are these applications or solutions that could make these sorts of systems more democratic and more serving for the average citizen?
Mm. Well, this is the age-old problem, right? It's 2022 and we've had politics for thousands of years of human civilization. But, you know, there is no perfect outcome. But we end up falling into a few categories of things you can do. The first one is price political decisions. So in the ACT example on rezoning, instead of this grey gift being given for free, we essentially charge for it the market price. And that's why we don't, for example, have corruption in the disposal of surplus government property, because we're obliged to go and take it to auction and fetch a market price. Whereas if we weren't pricing that, you'd end up with politicians giving away government property to their mates. So that's sort of the first one. In mining, we can think about pricing the right to mine periodically, where you have to show up every 5 years and buy at auction the right from the public to continue mining that site, whereas currently we just have some investment obligations. As long as you spend this much money, the minerals are yours and you pay the royalty. And the royalty is, you know, okay, but we can certainly do better. So pricing decisions is one approach. Another approach is to increase randomness in the choice of decision maker. So we started off talking about mates and political appointments, but what if we selected these appointments with a jury, a randomly drawn jury of citizens or, you know, the staff of a department, whatever the case may be, but we essentially take that decision-making power out of those mates' hands and give it back to the community through some kind of process of randomization. And that randomization makes it very difficult to then reciprocate favors back and forth, because you never know who's going to make the decision on those appointments in the future.
Cameron, it's a fascinating book, and you even say in your intro to the book that perhaps it turned into more of a how-to for those who want to be part of the game, but it's important for the rest of us to understand just how big the game is, and thank you for illuminating us on the scale of how rigged things can be in this country. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks, Andy.
Cameron K. Murray has been my guest in The Drawing Room, and Rigged, co-written with Paul Freiters, is out now through Allen and Unwin. And that's all we have time for. I'm Andy Park. I'll be back tomorrow from 6. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.